We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you
from the terrible secret of space.
Yes!
Haha!
Okay. It didn't take another 10 episodes. And now I can stop talking about it at the beginning of every recording. So that works out well for everybody.
Especially me. Because that means I can talk about space more.
Yep, we have more time for space. Not that we haven't been overrunning our time every
You might say
every
we have
episode.
Even more space for space.
More space for space.
Okay.
Okay. So as you might remember from last week's episode, we are going to be talking about habitats outside of Earth. And last week we talked about space-based habitats. So this week we're going to be talking about habitats that are located on some kind of celestial body that is not just free-floating.
And excluding the Earth, of course, because you're already there.
At least I think I am.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so we started last time with a rich history of the space habitats that humanity has constructed. We don't have a whole lot of ground-based habitats that we have constructed. Literally, the only thing that we can talk about is the history of the Apollo program, and only the history of some of the Apollo programs, specifically 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, which were all of the Apollo missions that actually made it to the moon successfully.
Not to downplay the importance of the Apollo missions, they were definitely some of the most badass times that NASA has ever done anything.
Seriously.
Straight up, we went to the moon in a decade. What?
Yeah.
Mic drop.
And the program itself holds the spot as being the only human space activity outside of low Earth orbit that we've ever done as a species. So, at least recorded as a species. I don't know, maybe somebody did something off the books. But as far as history is concerned right now, that's the only time that we've ever left our comfy little super corner of the cosmos to venture even the slightest bit out.
That being said, it was a while ago now, and darn it, we need to go up into space some more again.
Very true.
So with that, we're going to talk about that and some other stuff too.
Yep. So the Apollo landers are essentially, when we say the Apollo lander, we of course mean the lander module and the small habitat therein. So
the lunar excursion module, yes. Or LEM for the well-informed.
Or for the people who are addicted to acronyms. Otherwise known as not much bigger than a closet in some senses. It was enough for two people to pilot the craft down to the ground and enough space for them to take off their suits and possibly sleep. So it provided the most rudimentary of atmospheric control, temperature control, shielding from external radiation sources, and generally a good time. Probably not enough space for a tennis court, but that's neither here nor there.
Essentially, it was a rocket-propelled aluminum and mylar space tent with an airlock.
Basically. So the design that they had originally would only sustain a mission time of 48 hours. In Apollo 15, 16, and 17, they altered some of the design components with new technology and a bit more understanding of space mechanics and how we could send stuff up, and the removal of several unnecessary components on the module.
And the addition of a car, a space car,
true.
Also known as the Moon Rover or Moon Buggy.
I don't know if that's required for a habitat, but I really would be disappointed if I had to go into space without a car.
I mean, what else are you going to put in this space garage?
Yeah, seriously. So they had a mission time which was extended up from 48 hours to a maximum of 75 hours before they would start running a little bit short on air and water and everything else, which is honestly not a whole lot of time and certainly a far cry away from establishing a permanent space ground base, which is what we're here to talk about tonight. By a long shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a long weekend in space. As cool and romantic as that sounds, that's all we've done. But it's a far cry from what I think needs to be done to, you know, get stuff out there.
A romantic vacation buried in the lunar regolith.
You know, that would be terrible because the regolith would just cling to everything and just a mess everywhere.
So a future base needs several components which are required for human life, and they're pretty easy to list off because we've listed off literally all of these in several other episodes where we've discussed similar topics. First and foremost, how do I categorize these? I would say first and foremost would probably be air.
Mm-hmm. Air's good.
Air is nice. So oxygen, which is the only part of air that we super care about from a body processes standpoint, can be easily decomposed or easily electrolyzed out of water, along with hydrogen, which can be used for other applications. But it's the oxygen that we need to survive.
And nitrogen is good to have, because without nitrogen, you kind of have, you know, pure oxygen environments, and, well, Apollo 1.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
We don't need that.
No, but the good news is that once you've got nitrogen in the air, it really doesn't come out of the air, because you just breathe it in and breathe it out.
Yeah. So pressurized nitrogen and oxygen that we can get from local ice sources, which ties into the fact that water is generally available on most of the bodies that we're looking to colonize, either the moon, Mars, possibly asteroids. We'll get into some of those later. But ice exists in several forms in our solar system, and that makes access to water somewhat non-trivial for a small colony. Probably if you got to like a city-sized, you would start to have difficulty in keeping clean water available, given our current water treatment methods. But for a starting lunar base or Martian base or some such thing, it definitely wouldn't be a problem to harvest the ice that was already present.
Absolutely. The importance of water cannot be overstated. I mean, you literally need it for everything, and I know we've touched on it before and what it can all do. But it's pretty cool to think about that this is a fairly recent reevaluation of our extraterrestrial H2O, if you will. Because, you know, way back in the bygone days of astronomy, before we had super telescopes, you know, Mars was thought to have these flowing canals, and the moon was thought to have these lakes and whatnot. And then came the harsh reality of, hey, we've actually got good technology and telescopes and spectrometers and all this other good stuff. And we found out that that stuff is drier than any desert on Earth. So for a while, you know, the past most of my life, we've been going on thinking that there's pretty much no water in space except for the Earth and then the occasional comet. Well, everybody, surprise, surprise, for the good news for once, there's water freaking everywhere. It's not the easiest thing to get, but it's certainly there, and it's there in quite a lot, quite a great abundance. So, yeah.
Very true.
That makes it a lot easier than hauling it up from the Earth with us, and that saves money like you wouldn't believe. It basically takes, for instance, a $135 billion Martian exploration program and brings it down to a manageable $65 billion.
Yeah, it's only money. And that...
And I want it now.
Yeah, I want it now. So it takes about $10,000 per kilogram or so with current rocket technology to send something into low Earth orbit. So it definitely is a huge investment, especially since a kilogram of water isn't going to do you very good for a long period of time. So finding water on another planet is a huge deal, especially when we get into sections about astrobiology and the potential for water harboring life forms on other planets. But we've touched on that in previous episodes. We'll touch on it in future episodes. Suffice it to say, the only life we're currently concerned about right now is human life and how it's going to be sustained. And life wouldn't be anything except for some gruesome protuberances caused by cosmic radiation. Eh?
Eh.
Eh?
Eh.
Indeed. Radiation, as we've said before, is a huge contributing factor to the reason why space is so dangerous for complex organic life forms such as humans and
yeah,
bears.
Cosmic rays are like the shotgun shot, I guess, if you will, of the galaxy, piercing our weak flesh and going into our DNA and scattering our molecules and whatnot and generally causing a ruckus. It's like a really, really bad college frat party inside of your cells and your DNA, and they just leave a terrible mess, and then no one cleans it up, and so the police get called, and, well, you know, cancer, long of the short. And then you die.
Okay, that's good. I like that. Space cancer. Space yeah. Cops. Space cops. So radiation and radiation shielding will be a huge part of any space habitat, whether it be in orbit or be on the surface of a planet, if we pick the right planet, we might be able to have a magnetic field or atmosphere that is either present or that we can develop, which will shield us from oncoming radiation. Hence the reason why we aren't currently all dead here on the planet Earth is because we have natural factors that tend to filter out harmful radiation before it reaches us.
Absolutely, and that also produces some wonderful side effects such as the aurora borealis and the aurora australis. I think I said that right, which I get to enjoy from time to time, the former, not the latter.
I guess that kind of makes up for the five-hour-long days.
Yeah.
Up there in the frozen norths.
Yeah. Some darkness.
Yeah.
Darkness.
At least you get a good light show.
It would suck if this was Minecraft because it would be dark all the time.
Creepers.
I digress.
Forever. So, protection from radiation is something that is surmountable, at least in the short run. Any habitat can have sufficiently shielded walls that will probably need to be built up from local material, however, because, like we said, shipping up large quantities of heavy material is somewhat out of the question for a sustainable space program. So, shipping up any heavy metal that would be required to shield from the harmful types of radiation it might be encountering would be not so budget-friendly.
Not in the slightest.
In a word.
Yeah. And luckily, though, there's plenty of dirt on Mars and the Moon, and even asteroids have lots of stuff. And so even with, I think, about 8 meters or so of the regolith, you can find yourself in the nice, in some nice shielding, and you're not actually going to get French fried or nothing, or space cancer.
Space cancer.
Space cancer. Other things that you can, you know, use is a magnetic field that's artificially created. The only problem right now is we're still kind of working out the bit where you need such a strong magnetic field that's going to be so small, it's like, I don't want to say because I don't actually know. I thought it was like 200-something Teslas, but that seems like a low number. I just don't remember how much a Tesla's worth. And as far as magnets go, Mauser, we need your expertise on that one. Needless to say, though, strong magnets, as cool as they are, and you could see like the magnetic fields from Star Wars, the one downside is the fact that you have iron in your blood. And in a presence of a strong magnetic field that would potentially save you from harmful cosmic radiation, it would rip the iron out of your hemoglobin and you would find yourself in another world of problems. The least of which would be space cancer, but the most of which would be you can't be alive anymore because your blood's like broke.
You would suffocate to death while breathing, which would be unpleasant to say the least.
It would be very awkward.
Very awkward. So beyond the scope of what you need for humans to survive from a immediately not dying standpoint, food is going to become the next largest problem. And of course, with humans being somewhere, we also need the host of the things that keep us alive, which are several microbiomes worth of bacteria, which do everything from help us to continue to digest food in a positive way to sustaining crops as they grow. And with everything else, shipping up food from the Earth is possible, but not very likely. And if we are talking major colonies on a planetary body other than the Earth, we're definitely going to need some kind of local food processing operation of some sort.
Like Space Papa John's.
Yeah, like Space Papa John's. Because solar ovens would be amazing on Mars.
That's right. The best ingredients. But, in reality, though, we're looking at most likely bacterial and microbial cultures for that, because they pound for pound produce the best amount of food material. They've also been looking at algae, not quite the tastiest stuff. I mean, you're going to be drinking your green drink, but at least it's food, and you can have it in space. I know we've talked about it recently. I said that a couple times this episode, but they did just recently grow the first lettuce in space, so there's a plus. The only problem is that lettuce takes a while to grow, and then, well, you got to have a lot of place to put this whole big giant farm in your spacecraft and whatnot, but I digress again and say we're still working on that point, and we're going to try and make it work. The closed ecology piece has been really difficult, and with Biosphere 2 ending as a failure, for the most part, we're still trying to figure out exactly how we can have a closed ecology extended without incredible degradation.
Suffice it to say, when you remove a certain piece of the ecology from the greater scheme of things that is the Earth's total biome, then you get problems where there are unanticipated things that that ecology was relying on that you're no longer accounting for. So it's probably just a matter of time and experimentation until we can find the right combination of things to bring along with us and the right way to maintain them. So this problem in and of itself is entirely surmountable, especially when we can just use these bacterial and microbial cultures to kind of bioform any substance that we get close to into possibly supporting the crops that we would need to survive. It probably goes without saying we aren't going to be shipping many cows to the moon, though, so you could probably kiss burgers goodbye from the moon or from Mars or some other kind of habitat.
Luckily, everyone knows the moon is made of cheese, so the dairy market's already saturated.
Indeed it is.
With that.
With that.
So moving on.
The last two concerns of major importance are definitely surmountable, and we already know how to take care of them, which is why we're not too concerned about it. Power is, of course, important for any civilization, especially because we need our Wi-Fis and our iPods and our tablets and phones and all sorts of things. And probably, you know, to recirculate air.
And by then, probably our cyborg implants.
Our cyborg implants, you know, just the little things. So power is easily taken care of. We've got many different ways of producing power, mostly in space, especially in a place where there's no atmosphere and is still fairly close to the sun. Solar is the way to go because without an atmosphere to filter out a lot of the sunlight, you get buku power from solar panels, and that is fantastic. Other options, of course, are nuclear power generation, but as anybody who's seen a cutaway of a nuclear reactor knows, it's literally just a glorified steam engine being heated by decaying elements rather than, you know, coal or something, which would depend on water, which is something that you can generally find. So that's still not much of a problem.
You make nuclear power sound so bad, but it's such a good thing. It's so much more efficient than just solar panels, at least so far.
Yeah.
But as far as
the glorified steam engine, but
it uses Dr. Fabian is going to be having my head for this. I want to say it was the Rankine cycle. Brayton. No, that's a turbine engine. I digress. Thermodynamics. I obviously need to revisit that. But as far as being able to see the sun for your solar power, you're limited to probably about the orbit of Mars. After that, forget about solar power. You got to use something else.
Yeah. And depending on the body that you're on, if you're on the moon, you've got a 14 and a half-ish day on period of sunlight, and then you've got another 14 and a half-ish day of off sunlight. And on Mars, you've got a bit more consistency in your cycle, but you have to deal with the local weather in the form of dust. So there's a lot of factors that would influence how you would be able to deploy solar panels, but generally a combination of solar panels with decent maintenance and batteries will get you a good power supply on any body that's particularly close to Earth, you know, anything that we can reach reasonably soon.
That's right. Just don't forget your nuclear backup. Gotta have it.
There's always a nuclear option.
Always.
And for the benefit of biological life, gravity is of general importance, especially when it comes to developing biological life. We've seen several experiments with frogs and other forms that don't quite know what to do with themselves without gravity to tell them what to do with themselves.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily even gravity that we need. I mean, we just need the Force. Like from Star Wars, the Force?
Yes.
Okay, I wish it were that cool. But, I mean, obviously we don't need to have an artificial gravity generator. We could use a centrifuge of some sort, as I'm sure we've talked about ad nauseum in the past with our rotating space stations.
Indeed. So there are many solutions to developing for gravity in space. Not so many on the surface of a planet, per se, because that's kind of spinning as fast as it feels like spinning. But fortunately, any body that we would be generally inclined to settle upon is more than likely already home to a gravitational field of some sort that would allow us to develop different plants and animals and such naturally. And also to keep us from losing so much bone density that we're just kind of floating skeletons. But that's kind of a mixture of exercise more than anything.
Darn it, exercise. Darn it.
And I mean, we're going to know a lot more about that after this year in space experiment concludes.
Ah, Scott Kelly. He's almost done. Yeah, I bet he's excited to come home.
Yeah, they're getting close. But that is giving us a wealth of information about how the human body, a fully developed human body, like any astronaut would be going to a different planet to start a settlement, would react to a decreased or not, or nil gravity effect. So,
absolutely.
Looking forward to reading that.
Also, I know it wasn't planning on being a part of this conversation, but a huge, huge, huge aspect of Needs for Future Base is the psychological factor. People just get a little bit stir-crazy and cabin fever if they're locked up in a little coop slash habitation module day after day. And that's still something that we're working on. Even though we can do these amazing engineering and technological things, if we can't put two people in a tin can and ship them off for 3 to 6 months and not have them kill each other, that's a major accomplishment. So we got to work on that piece first. And we're working on that. We've got some projects going on. But that is going to be the topic of a future episode, so I won't get too much into that.
They should just take Netflix with them.
Yeah, seriously, just all the Netflix you can.
Yeah, why not?
It'd be Amazon fine. Prime, too. It's good,
yeah,
too.
Sure, they're good. Okay, so we've talked about what a future base needs. Now let's talk about the four-ish major places that a future base could be located. We have previously talked about lunar bases, and I realize this episode we've talked about a lot of these concepts piecemeal in other places, but we're kind of bringing it all together for this particular one. So the moon is close. It is got some ice. It has got quite a bit of daylight. And depending on where you situate your base, you can have different mixtures of, stuff that you can use. The problem with the moon, of course, is that as of yet, we don't have a good plan to turn any of the lunar regolith into a viable building material, so that's still the cost-prohibitive part, is we need shielding from radiation and from micrometeors and from less than micrometeors. So, larger than micrometeors. So we need some way to manufacture living space on that particular body.
Moon bricks, folks. Moon bricks.
Moon bricks.
Or Regos. As I like to call them. Yes. Regolith Legos.
Yes.
Patent pending.
I love it. So it's
so there's the moon.
Yeah, it's definitely a good option, but it'll take a little bit more in the way of experimenting and planning before we have a viable option for settling there.
Absolutely. And definitely probably our next best chance of going somewhere and living there because it's so darn close. It would be a great springboard for going to Mars, which is the next place we want to talk about. Mars, folks, our wonderful rusty neighbor, carbon dioxide atmosphere, very, very light. Its density is about all the same as the Earth's at 100,000 feet at Martian sea level. It's possibly livable, and that would be due to the fact that its weak magnetic field presents a radiation challenge as well. So you're likely looking at underground bases for any sustained period of time, just like the moon. And we're also looking to talk about The Martian.
Yeah. That book is actually quite inspiring. It's part of the things we've talked about on the podcast, and something that we talk about off the podcast that you guys don't get to hear, is Andy Weir really researched the book and tried to present it with as much realism as possible to how a habitat could survive on Mars and what kind of challenges humans would face in habitating a planet other than Earth. And a lot of the things that they talked about are definitely viable. Like, you can maintain a decent base and possibly establish some kind of agriculture on the planet, and solar energy is still useful there, and you can use technology to separate oxygen out of the carbon dioxide present in the atmosphere and from, recycling your own inner atmosphere.
Yep. And you can also make hydrocarbon fuel using the carbonyl process, not the carbon, the Sabatier process on Mars with hydrogen and a nickel catalyst. But I digress.
Yeah. So there are plenty of opportunities to expand into Mars. It has several things similar to Earth, a similar-ish day length. The atmosphere is there, but is very thin. If we could firm it up with some additional materials, we could possibly cause the surface temperature to rise to a more livable level, And introducing local bioforms onto the Martian soil is definitely a possibility for establishing a local ecology. Now, human beings in general don't have the best track record of introducing a species into an environment where that species was previously not present to beneficial results. So it's quite possible we could try this and we could totally screw it up, like really badly, like cause some kind of plague planet by introducing something that rapidly multiplies and mutates out of control into something that is entirely deadly to most forms of organic life. Like, we don't know.
And that sounds about like every other, you know, space colony horror movie.
Yeah.
Plague planet coming to a theater near you this December.
Why do we keep sending people here, Captain? I don't know, because the script told us to. I'm sorry.
But yeah, and going into how the heck we would actually do this whole process, I know you're starting this to rattle it off, but the National Geographic magazine had a really cool article in 2010 where they talked with NASA about the 1,000-year plan for colonizing Mars. And I will rattle it off right quick for you because it's pretty stinking interesting. So 1,000 years, we're going to colonize Mars, okay? Stick with me.
Okay.
So first we get there. 18-month survey missions. We're going to, you know, make that 6-month journey between Mars and the Earth and add a small habitation module to the base. So we're setting up our foundation for building more stuff. Within 100 years, we can make an atmosphere on Mars by releasing carbon dioxide, which is frozen in the dirt in the polar caps. Essentially, folks, we're going to greenhouse gas the heck out of Mars, which is what we've been doing to the Earth. So I think we'll be pretty good at that bit. All right. After that, and after 200 years now, so 200 years, folks, it's a long time, rain would fall and water would flow once enough carbon dioxide was released and the atmospheric pressure warmed the planet above freezing, which has got a ways to go. At that point, you can start to have simple organisms like lichens on rocks and microbes and algae and stuff. 600 years after our first mission to Mars, we can have like flowering plants and such, and it'd be great because boreal forests and, you know, alpine such and whatnot. So we're starting to get a little bit more Earth-like. 900 years later, we're looking at finally having enough energy for cities and actually planning to build things due to the ecology. Now, this is terraforming, by the way. How would you terraform? It takes 1,000 years.
Yeah, seriously.
And 1,000 years, at that point, the quote-unquote Martians would be able to go out with scuba gear because the oxygen is going to be low for millions of years on Mars. And then over the geologic time, before the Earth itself even becomes uninhabitable, Mars would again lose its new atmosphere and freeze back. So even though we could terraform Mars in 1,000 years, a couple more 1,000 years after that, if we didn't just keep doing it, Mars would go back to just the way it was because of its size and its place in space, essentially. But
yeah,
we talked about that before.
So it's something that is possible. I mean, we're talking about terraforming an entire planet. That requires technologies that we don't even have, and we can't even conceive of how we're going to do it yet. So it's a ways off. We are definitely still looking forward to the Mars missions planned in 2030 to 2035, depending on if NASA stays on time and on budget and we get the public interest up and such things. So,
and that's up to you, folks.
Yeah, it's something you got to work on. Get it in gear.
Come on, people. Let's all go, right. Planet. Captain Planet. Okay.
So,
and with that, asteroids, folks. Asteroids. Another fun topic for discussion. So we could also live on asteroids. It really is a cornucopia of resources out there, folks. We have asteroids for everything. You want an asteroid with iron on it? We got that for you. You want an asteroid made of ice and carbon? We got that for you. The only problem is we don't know which ones are which right now. There's so stinking many of them, and we just don't have large enough telescopes in space to be able to detect the material concentrations and exactly what they are. We can do a little bit of telescopic spectroscopy, words, but we're really inadequate right now as far as that's concerned. So once we are able to figure out all of the asteroids that are available to us and what they contain, the chances are we could pretty much just pick, we need an asteroid for this, this, and this, with this orbit, needs to have this amount of iron materials, this amount of carbon materials, and this amount of volatiles on it. And the chances are, because there's so many dang much of them out there, we could find the exact one that we want, but we just hadn't found it yet.
Very true. So you sound like you use Asteroid Dealer. So it's definitely something that we could do. Obviously, with asteroids, you've got, generally, it's farther away from the sun, so solar energy might not be a possible option. Gravity on asteroids is going to be very limited, depending on the size of the asteroid you pick.
Yeah, you might even just forget about the gravity. Yeah. That's going to be due to centrifugal forces.
And during our space-based habitats, we talked about the possibility of, you know, finding an iron asteroid and inflating it and building a colony on the inside. So it might end up that an asteroid ground-based habitat is actually a space-based habitat, which is possible. And would be kind of cool, living in a balloon of iron.
That'd be kind of fantastic.
Literal Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin, yeah! But
and
yeah.
Our last neighbor who is okay, let's Venus. Does anybody want to live on Venus? Sulfuric clouds?
Ooh.
92 bars of pressure on the surface?
Ooh. What does that even mean?
So
there's 92 bars of pressure? Like, that's how many bars there are? That's a lot of bars. That's like more bars than this downtown Las Vegas bars.
It's more bars
maybe
than
not
my
that many
cell phone.
Bars.
So, Earth's atmospheric pressure at sea level is 1 bar. So there's 92 bars of pressure on the surface of Venus on average. So it is soul-crushing and body-crushingly dense. Very dense. That's because their atmosphere is basically entirely CO2 with some sulfuric acid mixed in.
That's depressing.
So it is not... It's got 462 degrees Celsius... over the whole planet. So it's not a good place to live. I would not recommend putting a colony there at any time. Don't do it.
If you wanted to be optimistic,
if
you wanted to try it out, I would recommend, as opposed to a ground-based colony, that because you could take advantage of Venus's incredibly dense atmosphere, and you could build yourself a nice floating city. Kind of like Cloud City, but not really in the fact that you can float up there. More of the fact that you're going to be using, like, a literal Led Zeppelin. Like, you would need a Led Zeppelin, except more like concrete Zeppelin. Because lead would be eaten away by the sulfuric acid, I think.
Also, the temperatures on Venus are
sufficiently
hot to destroy.
Yeah, that too, and they would melt,
because
lead does that.
Yeah, so Venus is... I mean, I wouldn't never say that something is definitely not a possibility. I mean... Black holes are not a possibility, I'll say that. But I wouldn't recommend forming a colony on Venus anytime soon.
Yeah, Venus might be your fire, but definitely, definitely not your desire.
No.
And there's your disco reference for the day.
Yes. So the last bit that we want to talk about before we kick it off for the evening is, where is the money for this coming from? And there are always two sources of funding for just about everything. There's government and there's private. Government is probably not going to hack it, at least not if the budget trend for NASA is any indication. Because we're talking NASA's 2015 budget was about $885.5 million, which I was thinking was pretty high until Shover helpfully pointed out that that's 8 F-22s worth of budget.
Yeah.
And then I got sad.
Yeah. But hey, we've got really fancy planes that break all the time.
Yay. So, government funding is possible if public interest wildly shifted and all of a sudden all of our domestic interests shifted away from terrestrial problems and more to the subject of human expansion, which undoubtedly they would if it was revealed or something that an asteroid was going to collide with Earth in 20 years and we needed to get people, you know. There's a whole bunch of variability in how government spending will be affected, but assuming a nice, peaceful next couple of millennia, we are looking at definitely more private funding.
Yeah. The problem with that is that the private sector is a little bit frightened because of the massive amounts of capital involved, and for non-budget types, capital is like stuff. So you want to go to the moon, you need capital. What do you mean by capital? Well, you have a moon base. Moon base, how much that cost you? $62 billion. Oh, that's expensive. I mean, once you have it, it's nice and you can keep using it, but you have to pay up that initial upfront cost. And that's what's now is really, really inhibiting private sector spaceflight. So we're going to probably see some sort of hybrid government and private sector, at least from the United States perspective, for our space prospects. There is China. China would like to go to the moon and put on a short-term moon base by 2020. Well, folks, that's about 5 years from now. And I got to say, I am pretty optimistic with space stuff. But a moon base by 2020, probably not going to happen. Not even the United States could probably pull it off right about now. I'm not saying that China couldn't do it, but we're looking probably closer to 2030. Yeah. But honestly, though, they really want to go because they really want to prove that they are a global power and that they can do this cool stuff. Because everyone wants to be part of the Moon Club. Let's just be honest with that.
And let's face it, anybody who enhances humanity as a whole's understanding and exploration of space is all right in our book.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, China, that you want to do that. And I fully support that. And maybe when they do, we'll start another space race. And who knows? We'll do more space.
Yep. Nationwide pissing contests are definitely a good way for motivating exploration somehow.
Yeah.
It's just how it works, I guess. Well, all right. So that is a solid talk on space ground-based habitats on various celestial bodies.
Which are in space.
Which are in
still
space.
Still a space habitat, but so is your house because you're in space on the Earth. Spaceship Earth.
Everybody's in space.
Space.
All right, so until next time, I am the Pusher Robot.
And I am the Shover Robot.
And you have gone
down the stairs.
Because you know I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space, space travel. I'm all about that space.